to survival on the guerrilla battlefield, and continued well into the evening and at night, long after the training committee personnel had knocked off and gone home. The battalion trained on Saturdays, too, their time too short to be spent shining shoes and readying footlockers for the traditional, though meaningless in Vietnam terms, Saturday morning inspections. I had volunteer training for the gung-ho guys on Sundays and made recondo training available as well, with the successful graduates receiving the coveted black badge. I wrote a 17-page training memorandum that made a priority of the most basic of the basics, all of which the Army subject schedule gave short shrift to. How to whisper, sneeze, cough, or even just walk in the bush day and night. Most country boys learned these things before they were 10, but the Army of the day was not composed of country boys. Crawling, cover and concealment, security procedures, weapons maintenance, these two were at the top of the basics list, and when they were mastered, they replaced in the men their feeling of floundering with one of real confidence. Other new SOPs included the troops carrying their M16s at all times, loaded with blanks to get used to living in an armed environment, and the rifles routinely carried at the ready, even when marching from class to class. For all training outside the classroom or battalion area, the rule was full camouflage, black cork for faces and hands, tree branches in packs and helmets. Fort Lewis had never seen anything like this, and at first the 3rd of the 3rd was held up to a lot of ridicule. But while the system was laughing, my men were thinking Vietnam now, and after all, at this critical time of their lives, what else mattered? The troops responded well to the hard, hands-on, repetitive, but still interesting work. They may not have wanted to go to Vietnam, but they sure as hell didn't want to die there, so they even flocked to the off-duty volunteer classes like recondo. Meanwhile, I established the requirement that all officers and NCOs in the battalion read and carry on their person General Bruce Clark's Guidelines for the Leader and the Commander, as far as I was concerned, the finest little handbook on leadership and training ever written, and adopt as their own philosophy the one that I'd learned from a 5x7 card, which I still had, issued to me in Clark's 7th Army in Germany. An organization does well only those things the boss checks. That, and a constant reminder to the cadre to keep reminding their troops that the more sweat on the training field, the less blood on the battlefield, provided the foundation for a damn good, almost STRAC battalion. Another major plank in the 3rd of the 3rd's success was that while all the other training battalions at Fort Lewis and at the rest of the Army training centers were geared for the individual replacement system being used in Vietnam to keep units as close to strength as possible, from the very first day I viewed my battalion as a TOE regular unit and trained it as such. More than anything, this was an issue of spirit. I had long been an advocate of the unit replacement system, which the Australians used and had proved the worth of brilliantly in both Korea and Vietnam. The unit replacement system entailed troopers living, eating, sweating, and training as a team for a solid year before deploying together as a unit to the war zone, complete with the experienced cadre of regulars who'd trained them. This made the unit a family. The men loved one another and looked after one another. And as they took their lumps, they absorbed replacements from within the family as well through their own replacement package, perhaps an extra detachment brought along expressly for that purpose. In the unit replacement system, unit pride and devotion naturally resulted in pride and motivation among the individual soldiers who were part of the team. The resulting spirit was the key to getting things done and never giving in. According to its commander, when Hal Moore's 1st of the 7th Air Cav hung on against impossible odds during the Battle of Ya Drang, for example, the very thing that saved them was the bond of brotherhood the men shared. "We were victorious," Moore said, "a very small band of American soldiers who had trained, lived, and partied together for 2 years because we were determined to survive as a unit. We were disciplined as men and as a fighting team. And we knew that second place on that ground meant death for all of us and the battalion reputation. We could not accept that, and we won." As the U.S. war in Vietnam expanded and units like the Instant 196th Brigade began to be deployed not on the basis of combat readiness but on Westmoreland's need for more troops, any emphasis there might have been on a unit orientation quickly changed to an individual one, that is, replacements for units already in the field. By the time I hit Fort Lewis, 3 years into the piece, bodies were everything, and the object of the training had first and foremost become to get the new kids, like little plastic replacement parts, off the assembly line and into the action as fast as possible with minimum attrition. In the individual replacement system, the troops' complete bewilderment upon arrival in Vietnam had to be dealt with by complete strangers whose teams they joined, despite having no connection with their new teammates or understanding of the nature of the game being played. All the replacements suffered for this, but none worse than those inducted under the Project 100,000 program, which was nothing if not the most blatant example of the use and misuse of the poor and disadvantaged in America's wars. The theory was that each year 100,000 young men who had failed, or would fail if put to the test, the armed services' physical or mental requirements be given a chance to be soldiers. Standards were lowered to close to nothing, and the mostly black or lower-class white volunteers, seduced by recruiters' promises of training and skills to help them get along in the world outside the slums or the backwaters, soon found themselves stumbling along in the jungles of Vietnam. These men proceed through the army, Ward Just would soon write in Military Men, as they proceed through life, walking wounded in the center of a monstrous joke, forced to struggle with the basic training as they are forced to struggle with everything else. At the same time, the presence of these Project 100,000 soldiers, many of whom were uneducated and more than a few totally illiterate, could create quite significant problems within their units. In the infantry, you have to be able to think fast, communicate, and have confidence in your own judgment, none of which were easy tasks for these men who'd grown up as second-class citizens in the USA, and there were certain jobs they simply couldn't do. A soldier who could not read or write, for example, would make a very dangerous mortarman. At Lewis, I couldn't change the fact that my battalion would be together for only 9 weeks before being cast out individually to units all over Vietnam. But while I had them, I was determined that each 9-week cycle of men would be trained in the spirit of the unit replacement system with all the pride, stability, and values this entailed. Just one step in that direction was to nickname the 3rd of the 3rd the Always Alert Battalion and implement an airborne, all-the-way type drill for greetings between the soldiers and their officers. "Always alert," the battalion trooper would salute. "Stay alive," the battalion officer would respond. "Stay alert and stay alive" became the catch cry of the unit, with the men shouting it in unison at the beginning and end of every class they participated in. It wasn't anything new, though to someone who'd never trained troops, the whole drill no doubt seemed very Boy Scoutish, but it was a gimmick that worked, because it was a continuous reminder about how to survive on the battlefield, and it continually reinforced the Always Alert Battalion's collective identity, until its men were a cocky and spirited team. In the middle of my unit's transformation, I was called back to Fort Benning at the invitation of General Barry to attend the Dynamic Infantry Conference, a forum sponsored by the Army's Combat Development Command. There were maybe 200 people in attendance, both military and civilian, and the conference was designed to look at the infantry in terms of both the present and what the future, 10 and 20 years down the track, might bring. A significant portion of the program entailed the participants being broken down into panels of perhaps 12 men to work through given subjects or problems, with any findings and/or conclusions presented to the whole group at the end of the week's meetings. One panel I was on concerned the force structure of the Army of the future. From the outset of the meeting, the civilians were on the offensive. There was much evidence among them of long study at the Herman Kahn School of Instant Expertise as they pontificated on the Army's short- and long-term organization and equipment requirements, but because they spoke so glibly and knowingly, few military men objected or even questioned what was being said. the result, no doubt, of their own long-term attendance at the Herman Kahn School of bowing to overdeveloped civilian brains. Not so with me, however, or with Bird Colonel, subsequently two-star Michael J. Healy, whose 173rd Geronimo Battalion, trained and deployed as a unit under Healy's command, was reputed to have been one of the most successful in Vietnam. The distinction was shared with John P. Geraci's 1st of the 506th Centurion Battalion, which was similarly unit-trained. The two of us got into a very violent argument with the civilian PhD about machine guns, what their purpose should be, how many there should be in a platoon, and so on. The thing began when everyone on the panel, civilian and military alike, started nodding his head and agreeing with whatever this other civilian said. But the civilian was totally unqualified in the subject. He simply did not know what he was talking about. Healy and I, on the other hand, were more than qualified to talk about machine guns. Between us, we probably had 30 years infantry command experience on the squad, platoon, and company levels, and we had been handling machine guns since we were little more than kids. Yet even after the civilian, as good as admitted knowing very little about his subject at all, in answer to our pointed questions, Healy and I were singularly unsuccessful in swaying even our fellow military men to our combat-grounded point of view. To me, it was damn scary and did not bode well for a dynamic infantry future. On the plus side, the Dynamic Infantry Conference gave a lot of people a chance to catch up with old friends. I ran into old buddies there whom I hadn't seen in years. When the conference was over for the day, it was one big party for the rest of the night. At one of the more formal gatherings early in the week, I had a truly great thrill. I walked into a reception room only to hear a delighted, "That man, 20 years ago, woke me out of a sound sleep with a big grin and a .45 caliber pistol pointed in my face and in my own battalion area." It was Colonel James the Helmet Muir from my trust days, now a school department head, who had never forgotten my face or the morning my I&R squad plucked him, the aggressor commander, right out of his battalion area in full view of his own troops and taken him back to our HQ as the prize of the maneuver. Back at Fort Lewis, I turned my attention to my instant NCOs who did not have the luxury I had in Italy of almost 3 years in which to find my footing as a leader of men. While it would have been unfair to expect the shake-and-bakes to develop in a few months the leadership skills old NCOs took years and years to perfect, the extra support now at least got them going in the right direction as individual leaders or out of the program before they got someone killed. I tried to give the instant NCOs as much responsibility and training as possible within the battalion as squad leaders and platoon sergeants. One of the more frequent problems I saw was that of the good guy instant NCOs who were afraid not to be liked by their men. These were the ones who really had to be jumped on before they completely gave up all claim to a leadership role in their units. Often all this required was to explain to them that when they got to Vietnam, they would have a lot more friends in their squad or platoon if they just did their jobs and prevented their ill-prepared and generally poorly led buddies from getting themselves wasted the minute they left the base camp. The fledgling non-coms of the 3rd of the 3rd responded well to the responsibility thrust upon them, and all in all, I wasn't unhappy with the progress they were making. So it wasn't until the morning Captain James Mukoyama, acting battalion commander of the 4th Battalion 3rd Brigade, rang me at my office with a little problem that I realized how far the instant NCOs really were from the real thing. Mukoyama said there'd been an incident the night before in which one of my drill sergeants, black, about 6'1" or 6'2", wearing a 101st patch on the right, Mukoyama said, beat up one of his trainees. It was something you always had to be looking out for, but from the description I knew exactly who the offender was, and I was very surprised. Sergeant Martin was a regular Army paratrooper NCO, one of the very few at Lewis, from the 101st no less, and a damn good man. After telling Mukoyama to come right over, I sent word I wanted to see Martin pronto. "Sir, you've known me for a long time, and I don't brutalize nobody," the drill sergeant began when he arrived a short while later. "This is what happened. About 2100 hours last night, it was dark and I was driving home. But then I saw this soldier at the edge of the battalion area, and he was wearing Air Force gloves. Air Force gloves were hands in your pockets. I had a real thing about soldiers putting their hands in their pockets, and I'd told all my people if they saw anyone doing it to really smoke their asses, which is exactly what Martin had done. "Hey, trooper, get those hands out of your pockets," he'd said. "If you're that cold, get yourself some proper gloves, but you don't go stumbling around this battalion area wearing Air Force gloves." Unfortunately, the trooper was not too cooperative. In fact, he said, "Fuck you, Sergeant. I ain't in your battalion. I can do whatever I want." Understandably, this got Martin's attention, and he'd bolted out of his car. "You're talking to a sergeant in the U.S. Army, boy," he said to the trainee, "and you don't talk to me that way, you understand?" "Fuck you, U.S. Army sergeant," the kid retorted, which was a serious step too far. Martin grabbed the trooper and dragged him to the trainee's company orderly room, where a shake-and-bake NCO was charge of quarters. "Sergeant," Martin said to the CQ, "you got a room around here where I can talk to this boy in private?" The CQ pointed to the company commander's office. Martin dragged the kid in there and proceeded to administer some close and sustained NCO justice. As the story unfolded, as far as I was concerned, I couldn't see what the sergeant had done wrong. It was one of those things. You couldn't have sadists like Sergeant Keene in Berlin beating on kids trapped in cardboard boxes, but you couldn't have your sergeants without any authority either. The fundamental issue here was discipline, the final word in the life and death business of infantry. In the line of duty, Martin had told the kid to get his hands out of his pockets, and the kid had mouthed off to him. It was a clear breach of discipline. Martin could have turned him over to the CQ and pressed charges under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but he chose instead to do it the old Army way, which I not only condoned but would have done myself had I been in his shoes. The sergeant's mistake was he hadn't realized he was behaving old Army in front of an ultra-new Army NCO, a shake-and-bake who hadn't wanted to be in the Army in the first place and whose sympathies lay with the kid. So instead of looking the other way, as an old Army non-com would have, the instant Sergeant CQ wrote in the battalion journal how my man had savagely beaten one of the trainees. Now the kid was pressing charges, and the shake-and-bake was a witness. The only two bright spots in the affair were that both Martin and the trainee were black, which closed the door on charges of racism, and that Mukuyama, who'd been called at home by his duty officer soon after the incident, had gotten in touch with me as soon as I got to work at 0500. As it was, there was still very little time. The problem was that there'd been a number of similar incidents around the post lately, and a crackdown had been ordered. If the matter wasn't settled by the time the brigade people arrived for work at 0800, they would undoubtedly want Martin's head. But the Army could not afford to lose the few Martins it had left. So if I could just administer some sort of punishment before the brigade staff arrived, the process could be thwarted. To court-martial the man would be double jeopardy. I dismissed the drill sergeant and told him to both trust me and stand by. Meanwhile, Mukuyama arrived, and together we devised a scheme to save my man's career. James the Mook Mukuyama was a good man. I'd met him months before at Lewis's Training Center HQ when he was secretary to the general staff, and for me, it had been almost love at first sight. Instinctively, he'd reminded me of Jimmy Miyamura from the Raider days so long ago. As time passed, that instinct proved correct. Mook was a first-generation American of Japanese descent whose sense of duty, honor, and country without benefit of a West Point ring was that of someone who had not yet taken it all for granted. On top of that, like Jimmy Miyamura, the Mook was a stud. When we'd met, I couldn't understand why he, a regular Army infantry captain, was wasting his time behind a desk in a flunky HQ. I'd immediately offered him a company command in the 3rd of the 3rd, and it was just my bad luck he'd been about to take a similar job in the 4th of the 3rd Battalion. Events were proving, however, that that may have been all for the best, at least for Sergeant Martin. After rehearsing the plan, Mook and I called in the trainee, the drill sergeant, and the shake-and-bake. The trainee was, in my judgment, nothing more than a weak, whining punk. He was barely banged up, much less savagely beaten. My guess was Martin had bumped him up against the wall a few times and just scared the shit out of him. Mukayama explained to the trainee that I had reviewed the situation, that I decided the trainee was definitely in the right, and I was going to invoke a general court-martial against my drill sergeant if that's what the trainee still wanted. Yes, that's what he wanted. The only problem, Mook went on, was that both the trainee and the shake-and-bake would have to be confined to Fort Lewis as material witnesses until the court-martial, which could be weeks away given that it was almost Christmas.
You mean I can't go home for Christmas? Asked the trainee.
That's right, said the Mook.
But I'm going to Nam right after my leave, Captain, a worried shake-and-bake chimed in. I gotta see my mother. I gotta see my girl.
My hands are tied, Mukayama said sorrowfully. You want justice to be done, don't you?
Yes, but,
the trainee whimpered. Wait a minute, I said on cue. There is another way I could do this. I could give my man a non-judicial punishment, an Article 15 instead of the court-martial.
Could we go home if you gave him that? Asked the trainee.
Yes, you could, I replied. Of course, I couldn't hurt him as much as I'd like to. I could only take one stripe, fine him about $500, and restrict him for 30 days, which isn't all that severe.
Oh, I think that's severe enough, sir,
the trainee jumped in. You really think it's adequate?
Yes, sir, agreed the shake-and-bake, nodding his head vigorously. More than adequate, sir.
I turned to Martin. Sergeant, would you accept an Article 15? I assure you, you're getting away lightly.
Yes, sir, he replied. I will.
Fine, I said. I'll administer that punishment now. I dismissed the two young soldiers, who couldn't have been happier to split the scene. When Martin and I were alone and all the paperwork was being typed up, I said to the sergeant, I'm giving you an Article 15, and I'm fining you $500. But unless there's another incident, you won't be out a cent, and there'll be no black mark on your record because the paperwork will never leave my desk.
Airborne, sir, he said. But, Sergeant, if you ever have to do that kind of thing again, for Christ's sake, choose your witnesses a little more carefully.
Sir, he was a non-com.
The Army's changed, Martin. The Army's changed. By 0800, my desk was clear, with the Article 15 safely filed away. So when Lieutenant Colonel Moody, the by-the-book Brigade XO, called precisely at 0800, wanting explanations for the damaging log entry and demanding a court-martial, I was able to say, "It's been taken care of, sir." Bear his momentary wrath for not consulting him or Colonel Ponder before passing judgment, and then let the whole thing blow over, which it did. I did, however, call the shake-and-bake into my office to remind him he was now a non-commissioned officer in the U.S. Army. So stop thinking like a private, I said. It's a luxury you won't be able to afford on the battlefield when the real privates turn to you to keep them alive. I don't know whether the guy understood, but even if he did, I came out feeling as though I were swimming against the tide. If this kid was the quality, on the attitude level alone, of the instant NCOs coming through the system, combat forces in Vietnam could well be, at best, only marginally the better for them. And time would prove there were some damn lousy instant NCOs in Vietnam, but there were some damn good ones, too. The program wasn't perfect, but it was far better than nothing, and many men did respond to the philosophy at the root of it. Make men believe they are leaders, and they will become leaders. It had worked for me in Korea in F Company 223rd when Hudson, Smith, and Allison grew right into the stripes I'd given them out of desperation and a gutted NCO corps. The big problem that arose with the instant NCOs in Vietnam was that the school's system quickly made the measure of the program's success the same measure it used for everything else, a low attrition rate. Real motivation or basic leadership potential, which had been the basis of our success in fighter company, became virtually incidental in the output. This bored a huge hole in the whole concept of the program and the reason it had been conceived, but there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it. I had no authority to hire or fire, so all I could do was write letters about the problem to my influential friends, give my own men the best I could, and just hope for the best for the rest. And that included the kids who didn't want to go. For all my people who went to Vietnam,
I was going to be damn sure they got the very best training available in the U.S. Army. But for those who didn't want to, I did what I could to help them stay out. At the beginning of a new training cycle, I had each of my company commanders ask if anyone in his unit was a conscientious objector, CO. There was no point in training these guys in infantry if they could be gotten out early and trained in something else. And besides, many a CO went on to Vietnam to become a brave and competent combat medic, making the infantry's loss now the infantry's gain when it counted. When I interviewed the potential COs, I tried to help them get their stories straight. "I agree with you that it's a bad war," I'd say, "but that doesn't qualify you to be a CO. What religion are you?" "I don't have a religion." "Well, you better get one," I'd counsel, and send him on to the local padre or coffee house to make sure he knew the right words. When he came back to see me the next day, I'd pretend I'd never met him. After he said the right words, I'd make my recommendation that he be given CO status. I don't know what my motivation was. 20 years before, even 10 years before, I would have dealt with COs with extreme prejudice. Cowards, every damn one of them, I would have thought. But it was a different world now, and a different war, a war that just months earlier I'd sworn I'd take my son to Canada before I'd let him fight in, a war without a villain. Nationalists fighting for a better deal were not exactly Hitler or Tojo. So if a guy didn't want to fight, why should he fight? There were plenty who wanted to, or were programmed by fathers or family histories to think they wanted to prove their manhood or as a point of honor and hang the cause. The interesting twist about my conscientious objector policy at Fort Lewis, though, was that with the option available in the third of the third, I actually had fewer guys bucking for CO status than in other battalions in the brigade. In mid-December, I was selected early for the Army War College. I was very proud. First, because I was picked up in the very first year of eligibility, my 14th year of regular service, while most guys might wait 6 or 8 more years after that. And second, because despite the fact I'd been told so often by men in the know that I was viewed as a comer and a shoe-in for War College and an early star, I'd learned when I was not selected for major in Germany never to count on anything. And after all, not too many people who start off a buck private in the rear ranks at age 15 make the big league, as I'd wrote to Ward Just with the news. The personnel people were not in the least impressed with the good word. In fact, they were indignant. I'd escaped my Pentagon jail term early. I'd purposely, even eagerly, taken the retrograde and disastrous career step of a training battalion at Fort Lewis. I'd ignored the personnel guy's advice entirely, and I'd still made the War College list below the zone. It pissed them off royally, and only added to my joy. I took leave over the Christmas holidays and drove the family to L.A. to spend Christmas with Roy and his new bride, Helen. With 3 crumb snatchers less than 9 years old cooped up in a station wagon for 3 days, the drive was worse than combat. Fortunately, everyone survived, and there was even time to relax for a few days until just before New Year's, 1969, when I received an 0500 call from OPO at the Pentagon. The time of the call was significant. It was 0800 in Washington, D.C., and my caller's lack of respect for the 3-hour time difference to the West Coast was typical of the no-think, can-do attitude that characterized the Army bureaucracy of the day. "General Ewell wants you to take a battalion in his division," the OPO voice informed me now. "He's requested you by name. We don't recommend it. You've had 2 battalions. You have nothing to gain, and there's a long line of others who've never had a battalion and are still waiting. You would have to defer War College, and if you go, you'll only get in trouble and ruin your chances for a star. We recommend you stay at Lewis until War College in August." "When do I leave?" I replied. Patty could have killed me. Even I was surprised at how easily I made the decision, particularly given the intensity of the inner struggle that had been going on since my tour with SLAM, which had me always wanting to go back to the fray even as all I wanted to do was quit and disappear before the anger over the senselessness of it all blew up inside me. When I'd read USMC Lieutenant Colonel William Corson's The Betrayal, then recently published about the folly of the U.S. pacification effort in Vietnam, I'd recognized that as another drop of water on the rock, after Dr. Benjamin, after Ward Just, toward a truer way of seeing, and for the first time had begun to see myself very comfortably removed from both the conflict and the inept managers responsible for it. Meanwhile, in the personal realm, I was very happy at Fort Lewis. I wasn't bored. Patty and I got along fine, and I enjoyed being with the kids. We had beautiful quarters, a big modern Western-style four-bedroom house in a well-forested, secluded part of the post. Tim Grattan, my closest friend, lived in Bellevue, where he was already making big bucks in land development. We got together frequently, and really, until the moment the opportunity came to go back to Vietnam, at least a part of me had planned to give even War College a miss, retire right there, and go to work with Tim. But the opportunity did arise, and though I knew the war was a totally senseless exercise, I took it. It was almost as if the decision had been made for me. But when I wrote to Ward Just to tell him my change of plans, I tried to explain, despite my close and sustained criticism of it all, why. "I am a professional," I wrote. "A pro doesn't sit on the bench simply because he has played out his quota of time. He wants to get in there, mix it up, and contribute towards moving the ball toward his goal line, regardless of what the chances of winning are. I know my job. Through my skill, developed through long experience and hard study, I can get the job done at the least possible costs to the young citizen soldiers who make up the thin red line. I have many tactical ideas and theories concerning how to fight the guerrilla which I have been mulling over since my last tour. I would like to prove to the traditionalists that there is another way to fight the G rather than high-diddle-diddle right down the middle. If I am overwhelmingly successful, I might possibly influence the proponents of the unsuccessful search-and-destroy operations. At least my credentials will back up my arguments a little better. I cannot think of a profession that is more demanding, deadly, and where the responsibility is more awesome. As you well know, mistakes that are made on the battlefield cannot be covered up. They always clearly show themselves on the casualty lists. Thus, I think that our units in Vietnam should have the finest leaders possible at the expense of these leaders, who are regulars and, goddammit, should be prepared to pay the price. Personal discomforts, family, and career development, such as attending war college. Christ, we didn't send commanders home during World War II for schooling. Why Vietnam? Why, indeed. Over the next 2 weeks, while good soldier Patty got the house and the family squared away for the 12th move in 11 years, I got on the phone to begin assembling my team. The word was the battalion I was about to take over was very sick. I figured if I had about 10 good studs, we could easily knock it into shape. It really was my dream to mold a combat battalion into a perfect fighting force. Can always go to war college, but cannot always fight a battalion, as I wrote in less than lofty terms to X-327 Tiger Major Nev Bumstead, who'd become a good friend, whose judgment and attention to detail I respected, and whom I wanted for my S-3. My only regret was that Hank Emerson would not be my brigade commander. He was actually out of the 9th Division entirely, having been shot down in a chopper in September and evacuated back to the States with severe burns. Hank Emerson did not have good luck with helicopters. In just one of a number of previous instances, once with the 1st of the 101st at Lai K, he'd been so focused on a particular action that he insisted on landing in a mushy rice paddy despite his pilot's warning. The chopper landed, and Hank jumped out. But because the skids kind of sank down into the paddy, when Hank, who was exceptionally tall, went to step up on a nearby paddy dike, the chopper's rotor blade knocked him right in the head. He went sailing 20 feet. Incredibly, when he got up, he was more or less unscathed. As it turned out, the rotor blade had missed him completely, even as it crushed in the top of his helmet. In the 9th Division case, he was not quite as fortunate. He suffered some bad burns when he was trapped inside his downed chopper by a ruptured safety belt. Colonel Ira H. Hunt, the division chief of staff, who'd been flying with Hank, braved the fire licking through the aircraft to cut Hank free and drag him out. Some 10 seconds later, the helicopter erupted in a ball of flame and disintegrated before their eyes.
Fortunately, the gunfighter healed up beautifully and continued on with his fine career. Still, I knew I'd have no trouble from above, because Hank was one of General Ewell's boys, and I was one of Hank's. General Ewell, who'd asked for me by name as per Hank's recommendation, would respect me as per same to get the job done. That was the way it worked, and as the reality of my imminent return to Vietnam sank in, I couldn't wait to get back in the game. I'd been at Lewis for 4.5 months, able to put my mark on just 2 full cycles of AIT trainees. It was but a tiny drop in a huge ocean, even though I did get very real satisfaction from the cheery always alerts and snappy salutes I got from occasional 3-3 graduates who recognized or served under me in subsequent years in Vietnam. In the end, my only lasting contribution to the AIT program was in thwarting the Army bureaucracy in one tiny way when one of my cycles somehow finished a few days early, but because of some Army regulation, the soldiers weren't allowed to leave Fort Lewis until the originally scheduled date. It was crazy to expect 1,000 men on their way to Vietnam to sit on their asses at Fort Lewis for 2 or 3 days doing nothing, when they could be home with their families or their girlfriends. So I raised hell and yelled and screamed all the way up to General Beverly to let them go. But regs were regs, and no one would budge. Fortunately, by now I knew how to manipulate the system on almost every level, and I had contacts everywhere. In this case, I called General Pearson at the Pentagon, and before the day was out, he'd sent a cable to Lewis stating that not only were these men to be allowed to go home immediately, but that the same would apply in any cases like this at any of the other training centers. It was a small victory. I left Fort Lewis wondering if it would have been better if I'd gone there before my Pentagon stint rather than after. While the Pentagon statistics and all outward appearances pointed to max efficiency, my eyes had now told me the training system was in shambles. The curriculum was myopic and rigid, 1,000,000 unbridgeable miles from the present battlefield when there should have been a direct line. By the time the product of these training centers was tested and proved deficient, it was too late to make adjustments or corrections. Had I known this at the Pentagon, I might have made a project of getting every U.S. Army training center to have a stud who really understood the war as a liaison on the ground in Vietnam. These guys' entire jobs would be to bop around the country, looking at the units and looking at the war. They'd check in with graduates of their particular training centers, find out how they were and what training areas the now battle-wise soldiers believed needed expanding. Then the liaisons would report their findings back to their training centers, along with their thoughts on the direction the training should be going. Had I known at the Pentagon the terrible plight of trainees under the tutelage of short-timer snowbird instructors, I might have pushed to have the training schedule lengthened up front to eliminate the short-timers entirely, and in the process, double, at the very least, the training value for everybody. And why were passed-over, washed-out officers vegetating and waiting for their final parades in one of the most important jobs in the U.S. Army? Training centers and Army service schools should have been manned by the Steve Prezenkas and the Glover Johnses. Why not Prezenka and Johnses themselves? Had I still been at the Pentagon, I might have pushed to have these warriors and others like them recalled from retirement. We were in a war. We didn't need any more dancing, prancing chief of staff material complete with master's degrees from Harvard. We needed experienced men who could train soldiers for combat. These men wouldn't leave the United States. They'd just make sure the ones who did came back. As now retired Colonel Johns wrote to me on the subject, "We are thrown out on our ass at 55 if we have not been touched by the magic finger of fate and come up with a star, regardless of how good we might be at something. Do you think that maybe I, without my star, could not have done a better job of teaching tactics at Benning than a lot of the young kids were doing if I had been sent to Vietnam for a few months to see how it was, free to move around and go and do what I wanted, like go on a patrol or BS with the GIs? Yes, Johns could have. And for the sake of the students, he should have been given the chance. I feel strongly, he continued,
that the more efficient and experienced older officers, even if they know they will not be promoted, should at least be given the opportunity to stay on in the capacity of a permanent instructor, complete with refresher courses in the field themselves. There are so many jobs that young officers on the way up neither want nor need that could be filled by older officers that the Army would do well to seek a special category for such officers that would in no way interfere with the rapid promotion of the others, and at the same time keep happy and healthy and useful a lot of men who had devoted their lives to their country, knew no other bag, and could do a magnificent job for their country still. It was a solution that could have worked if someone had been in the right place at the right time, with enough gelignite to upend Mount Everest. But no one was moving mountains, and having done my time in the Pentagon, where, far from the cutting edge, it was so easy to be fooled by the completely institutionalized appearance of total perfection, and then down on the ground level at Fort Lewis, where attention to detail was virtually a mortal sin, I doubted such a sensible idea was even broachable without dismantling the Army's training apparatus and starting from scratch. But since that wasn't going to happen either, it seemed as if the machine would just keep on cranking out young men who were not prepared for the ordeal ahead, who would survive, if they survived, by hook or by crook, but with little thanks to the U.S. Army. It was no way to run a war. 19. Hardcore. Hackworth was essentially a legend. Just before he arrived, I recall going to the G1 and asking who the new battalion commander was going to be. The deputy G1 said, "Can't tell you. You know how personnel people are. They like to hip-pocket everything. But he's Mr. Infantry." I thought, who the hell is Mr. Infantry? Of course, I'd read about David H. Hackworth. Colonel George Mergner, United States Army, Executive Officer, 4th of the 39th Infantry Battalion, Republic of Vietnam, 1969. Doc Holly and I were sitting in the aid station drinking beer and saying, "God, this is going to be hell. We've got some G.I. Joe lifer out here who's going to just ruin us." That was probably the lowest point of morale in the battalion. Not only had we been taking a lot of casualties, but now it looked as if somebody was going to come in and kick ass and make career soldiers out of us. Charles Windsor, Medic, Headquarters Company, 4th of the 39th Infantry Battalion, Republic of Vietnam, 1969. One of the guys who talked to me was an E6 or E7 in charge of communications. He said, "Look, Captain, there's a price out on Hackworth's head. You gotta stay away from him, because someone's going to shoot him." I said, "My job is to stay in his hip pocket." He said, "Somebody's going to kill him here. Within the next week, he's going to be a dead man, so I'm telling you to stay away from him." Well, what do you do with information like this? Colonel Emil Robert, United States Army, retired, 4th of the 39th Artillery Liaison Officer, Republic of Vietnam, 1969. As for the bounty, I heard it was $800, no questions asked. I only heard of someone taking a few shots at a helicopter he was flying in. I also remember somebody giving that person hell for shooting at the helicopter because there were other innocent people in there who may be killed accidentally. Daniel E. Evans, Jr., DVM, Medic, DSC winner, B Company, 4th of the 39th Infantry Battalion, Republic of Vietnam, 1968-69. "I might not be able to write for a week or so. The new commander is a little crazy, and I think he will be relieved of command shortly. He is pushing the men too hard. I'll explain later." Dan Evans, letter home dated 4 February, 1969. "We were rotten before we started. We was never disciplined. We made it out of favor if an order was obeyed. Yes, every little drummer had his rights and wrongs to mind. So we had to pay for teaching, and we did." Rudyard Kipling. There was no sense in showing this sorry outfit. I was in a state of shock. It wasn't just that the CP group slept in cots inside tents, that they had folding chairs and stateside footlockers, portable radios and plastic coolers filled with beer and coke at their fire base out in the field. More than that, it was that they had portable toilets, too, the result, I was told, of my predecessor's philosophy that for a penny more you can go first class, and apparently were blissfully unaware that just nearby their troops were crapping on the ground and not even covering it up. In the sanitation department, the fire base was even worse than the ROK defensive position we took over at the Punch Bowl in Korea in 1953. "It's a pussy battalion," General Yule had explained when I first arrived in country. "And I want tigers, not pussies," he'd gone on to say in his characteristic Oklahoma drawl. But he'd gotten it wrong. With the 4th Battalion, 39th Infantry, it was not a question of feline degree. As far as I could see, this unit was not even a military organization. It was total disintegration. Throughout the firebase, amid the shit and the toilet paper and the machine gun ammo laying in the mud, were troops who wore love beads and peace symbols and looked more like something out of Haight Ashbury than soldiers in the U.S. Army. All were low on spirit, and a few were high, openly, on marijuana. There was minimum security. Few men carried or cared for their weapons. Most had let them go red with rust as they strolled around without them. Grenades weren't taped, and when a unit moved out, most of the gunners wore their ammo Pancho Villa style, the ideal way to guarantee a weapon jam sometime down the track when dirty, dented cartridges were inserted into their M60s. The 439's firebase was located in the Wagon Wheel, an AO so named for the five canals that converged there, which, from the air, looked like the hub and spokes of a wheel. The night before I took over the battalion, I sat up all night in the center of the base, back-to-back with Nev Bumstead, who'd come along as my hand-picked S3. Neither of us was game to sleep. If the VC attacked, the battle would be over before it even began, with the position safely in enemy hands. So I spent the time discussing with Nev the things we'd have to do to turn the lackluster unit around and ruminating on how such disintegration ever could have occurred. It would be fair to say that my own on-the-ground observations did not exactly reflect the spirit, morale, and devotion to duty among the personnel in Vietnam that Conark CG, now 4-star General James Woolnow, observed and wrote about to Chief of Staff Westmoreland less than a month before during his whirlwind 9-day trip to the war zone. Woolnow told the chief that the almost universal opinion among those he'd spoken with was that the young officers and EM being sent to Vietnam were indeed properly prepared for combat both by training and mental conditioning. One would have thought that Woolnow, who as Desper had been so shocked by the results of our friendly fire study and so helpful in implementing change, would have been somewhat more discerning. Though his memo to Westy was unknown to me at the time, I wonder how that January 1969 finding would have gone over with the parents of the draftee replacement in my battalion who, about 4 days after I arrived, set up a clearly marked claymore mine backwards in front of his position, heard something in the night, and blew his own head off. What a mistake it was to listen to the generals of corporate HQ who were briefed only in zero defect terms and, so far from the cutting edge, expected nothing less. It was among the biggest mistakes of the war. The politicians only listened to these generals and these generals to themselves. Few people asked the frontline soldiers, the only ones who really knew. After 9 days on the ground in Vietnam, Woolnow had been able to offer Westmoreland the informed opinions that the war had already been won militarily and what is left appears to be a mopping up operation. I do not believe, Woolnow continued, that in the current situation the enemy has the capability to more than harass us. I did not find a division commander who disagreed with this conclusion with respect to his own TAO, Tactical Area of Operation. As I waited for dawn at the 4th of the 39 firebase, I considered the harassment my new command had been on the wrong end of for the past 6 months. Whatever the name one ascribed to it, it had gutted the unit both physically and emotionally. According to the old-timers, they had not met the enemy at all, yet they had taken tremendous casualties. When I arrived, the Dick Board, a tally board Battalion Operations Sergeant Jerry Slatter had been tasked to set up to keep track of casualties, read, Dicks, 0 KIA, 0 WIA, 0 POW. Friendly, 24 KIA, 485 WIA.
Rockets, mortars, booby traps, and friendly fire were responsible for these tragic figures, and with the rifle companies usually operating at 50% of TOE strength, over 6 months, those faceless menaces accounted for the equivalent of 100% casualties in the unit. No wonder morale was lower than whale shit. The following day, I took over the battalion from Lieutenant Colonel Franklin A. Hart in a parade field change of command in the middle of the Mekong Delta. What kind of war have I gotten myself into? I wondered. A perfectly starched General Ewell was there, having flown in for the occasion in his polished chopper. There were other brass, too, and photographers, the American flag, the battalion colors, which were ceremoniously passed to me, and all this before the scroungiest, most spiritless assembly of soldiers I'd ever seen. Incredibly, none of the generals or colonels seemed to notice the slack condition of my new charges or their positions. And despite Ewell's earlier remarks to me, or those of the 1st Brigade CO, Colonel John P. Geraci, who told me the 4th of the 39th was the worst battalion he had, Frank Hart would still receive a Legion of Merit for his job well done with the battalion. It was hard to believe that as late as 1968, the Army was still bringing in lieutenant colonels looking for their first CIB, as one battle-wise battalion officer and friend put it, but that was the story with Hart. While men like Gib Gibson, so eminently qualified for command, and who cared to do nothing else, couldn't get in the troop-leading door, it seemed to me as if water walkers like this guy, 21st in his West Point class, he'd been General Westmoreland's aide and would be again, could transparently get their first and only combat command ticket punched and even win 3 Silver Stars and a Legion of Merit while their dick boards remained blank and their soldiers' morale wasted away. Finally, General Ewell and the other guests flew off, and the battalion was mine. I thought of Colonel, later Major General, Numa A. Watson, my trust regimental commander, and of the time when I was a corporal and my squad was acting as a battalion CP for a command post exercise. Our job was simply to feed canned information via radio to regiment in the troopless maneuver designed to train the regimental staff. But in the middle of it, Watson came by and said to me, "You're running a fine battalion here, Colonel." He was just playing with me, of course, but being called Colonel was such a thrill I never forgot the words. It was hard to believe that now, 2 decades later, I really was a colonel, a light colonel anyway, and I had the battalion I'd been preparing for all those years. Little could I have guessed that whipping it into shape would require every bit of knowledge I had gained in the interim. From the outset, I realized that to make this unit an effective military force, I'd have to implement about 1,000 changes. So I figured we'd start with 5 a day. Little things, basic things like wear your steel pot, and clean and carry your rifle at all times, and ammunition will not be worn Pancho Villa style. My first order was that, come darkness, the fire support base perimeter would pull back 300 meters. The troops instantly began to grumble at this, but it was the next order that really began the mutinous feeling within my hard luck outfit. "Anything you can't carry 24 hours a day," I intoned, "is gone on the next chopper. Goodbye tents and cots and rucksacks and footlockers." The bitching and moaning began in earnest as piles and piles of junk mounted at the LZ to be whisked away by Chinook. But I didn't care. I wasn't there to have them like me. By midnight, as per my instructions, the battalion was dug in new positions with security out. A short time later, we were hit with a barrage of rocket and recoilless rifle fire, but most of it fell on the old positions. When I got on the horn and called for artillery, I was surprised to find that I was very nervous. Command is not like hopping back onto a bicycle, and after 2.5 years away from it, I was rusty and actually scared I'd screw up. But then I heard a guy, later to be identified as Lieutenant Larry Taller, who worked in the S3 section, running behind me to his defensive position. "He's a mean son of a bitch, but he knows what he's doing," Taller said as he ran, and I knew I was back. The following morning, Bob Press, the ABU's first sergeant in our shared first of the 101st days, whom I'd nabbed for my sergeant major in the 4th of the 39th, reported he'd already noted a big decrease in the bitching as he toured around the perimeter.
It hadn't gone unnoticed by the troops that there'd been no casualties the night before, where, in Press's estimation, at least 20 would have been headed for hospitals or zipped up in body bags had they been sleeping on cots or even just above ground. So I won a few hearts and minds the first night, but none too many. For the first month I was with the unit, I refused to crack a smile, and by constantly demanding professionalism from everyone, just about everything I did pissed somebody off. I did some wholesale firing of personnel. All told, throughout the tour, some 59 lieutenants, 8 captains, and 2 majors, following the "there are no bad units, only bad officers" philosophy of General Cleland. And after a few days, I heard petitions had started going around the companies, stating that in protest, the men weren't going to go out on missions anymore. Fortunately, I was cut some slack in at least one quarter. The CO of A Company, whom I'll call Captain Billy Winston, had served in the 1st of the 101st in 65-66, and we'd known each other. So he brought his guys together, told them I might not be perfect, but I wasn't that bad, and they ought to give me a chance. The bounty Bravo Company put on my head, which ranged from $800 to $3,500, depending on whom you talk to, was also fairly easily dismissed. The first I heard of it was when General Ewell, of all people, got the word and came to warn me. He said he was going to infiltrate some CID people into the company to ferret out the ringleaders of the plot. Meanwhile, he strongly suggested I ease up on the troops. I wasn't going to ease up and told the general so. Besides, there was a simpler way to call Bravo's bluff. Before long, we were conducting operations, and on one of them I found myself with Fractious B Company, all of us approaching in a skirmish line, a small enemy force in a clump of the Delta's ubiquitous nipa palm. A fight seemed imminent, and since my experience told me that soldiers in a firefight are generally too busy, too scared, and place far too much faith in their leader's ability to get them out safely, to knock him off, I felt it was a perfectly unperilous, for me, opportunity to make Bravo shit or get off the pot. So I moved up well in front of the advancing skirmish line, with my back an easy target for even the sorriest rifleman in Vietnam. And I was right. Thoughts of wasting the battalion commander were forgotten as the little fight heated up. Working together with a common purpose, we killed a few VC in exchange for not a single B Company casualty. And I don't think I heard much about a price on my head ever again. The men of the 4th of the 39th had no unit identity and no pride in themselves. As a first step toward rectifying this, I decided to call my hard luck battalion the Hard Corps and the troops Recondos, the latter being the nickname of the 1st Brigade 9th Division, of which the 4th of the 39th was a part. Just as I had in the 3rd of the 3rd at Fort Lewis, I insisted on an airborne all-the-way greeting between the 4th of the 39th's soldiers and their officers. When a soldier saluted an officer, he said, "Hardcore Recondo, sir." And when the officer responded, it was with a heartfelt, "No fucking slack." At first, my cynical hippie troops sniggered over what they considered G.I. Joe bullshit. But it didn't matter. I knew the time would come when it would mean one hell of a lot to each and every one of them. Simultaneously, I started establishing SOPs that would not only keep troops alive, but also give them, for the first time, the feeling that they were in charge of their situation, not at the mercy of the VC or their insidious booby traps. The battalion overall was composed mostly of draftees, and many had actually assumed that the way they lived and got blown away under my predecessor, without ever meeting the enemy, was how it was supposed to be. The SOPs included such things as every officer having to read Mao's Little Red Book. How could we beat an enemy if we made no attempt to know what made him tick? And 100% stand twos prior to dawn, dusk, and sometimes in the middle of the night, any of which might occasionally be augmented with a mad minute. I was vastly assisted in the implementation of these procedures by both Bumstead and my XO, a superb officer named George Mergner. In that Mergner was not part of the team I brought with me, and I hadn't known him before, his thoroughly competent presence in the battalion came as a wonderful surprise. Besides being a fine soldier with a couple of years' Delta combat experience as an advisor under his belt, George was the perfect foil for me, and it was for good reason I dubbed us the animal and the intellect, and no big mystery who was who. While Bumstead, Mergner, and I worked 20 hours a day in an effort to get the officers and troops in the field up to scratch, Sergeant Major Press went back to Dong Tam, home of the 600-acre 9th Division base camp, to sort out the battalion rear area. It was a hell of a mess. The unit had turned over dozens of times throughout the past 2 years on virtually an individual basis, and the absence of continuity during that period had permitted metal shipping containers, known as connexes, to be left unopened and gathering dust for God only knew how long. Also, the longtime absence of discipline and attention to detail among the leadership of the battalion had allowed some 150 lame and lazy not-so-hardcore 4th of the 39th Troopers to get permanently lost inside the sprawling division facility, which more than anything was like a war zone country club, complete with virtually every amenity known to man, including a miniature golf course. The first thing Press did was open up the connexes. Inside, besides the beer and coke and personal belongings of guys who died, been evacuated, or rotated home long before, he found hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of brand new, totally forgotten equipment. Rifles, starlight scopes, machine guns, you name it. The find was a perfect example of the waste, inefficiency, and complete disorganization inherent in the individual rather than unit replacement system. But it was also a